The Story Factor Podcast, episode number 7, facilitating groups and finding stories and understanding what they mean.
Welcome to the Story Factor Podcast with Annette Simmons.
Story is the oldest form of influence in human history.
Annette is the author of The Story Factor, Territorial Games, and Whoever Tells the Best Story Wins.
When you stimulate human emotions with a story, you point those emotions in a certain direction.
Now Annette is here to help you inspire, influence, and persuade through the art of storytelling.
No one will complain if you substitute a story for a PowerPoint slide.
Notice I'm not using PowerPoint and there's no handouts. My goal is that this actually be valuable enough that you remember it.
And now your host, she occasionally rides a horse named Peanut. Here's Annette Simmons.
Hi, this is Annette Simmons and welcome to the Story Factor Podcast. I believe that no matter who you are or what you do, your life will become more meaningful when you begin to use storytelling. I'll be taking a ride on Peanut this morning, in fact. It's the best part of my week. There is nothing better than getting out in nature and enjoying the cool morning air on the back of a horse. Earlier this year, I got a phone call from someone who asked me to tell him my best storytelling tool. He talked to all the storytelling people I know and many I've never heard of, and he now has a rich bank of storytelling tools that he promises to publish for us all very soon. Today I'll be talking to him and you can hear about some of the tools that he's gathered. Before we get started, a quick reminder, I want to hear your story. You can connect with me and the Story Factor podcast. Find us on YouTube, Twitter. We've got all those links at AnnetteSimmons.com, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. You could record a message or email me. If you want to record a message, call on the feedback line at 318-479-1077. Today, I'm talking to David Hutchins, an incredibly creative writer, speaker, and trainer who's published 5 business fable books about trust, mindsets, learning, creativity, and purpose. He's designed simulations, and now he offers to take groups deep into NASA, the Olympics, or the Gettysburg battlefield with experiential events. David can be found at davidhutchins.com. That's Hutchins with an E-N-S. I ask him about the story tools that he's gathered, and from all of those interviews, he talks with us about what kind of tools that he's gathered, and I ask him, what do they do?
The idea is to introduce facilitated processes and tools that team leaders and managers and other organizational practitioners can use to begin finding the key stories in their work and in their functions in their teams. So some story mining work, then some story crafting processes. It's not how do you tell a great story, it's how do you tell a strategic story. A story that's important to the work. And then processes for meaning making. How do we now take these stories and start drawing some meaning out of it? When you tell the story, the work isn't done. We don't just tell a story and say, oh, that was a great story, let's get back to work. No, the work is just beginning when you've told the story. Now there's all this meaning to unpack from the story. Stories are incredibly efficient containers of knowledge and mental models and assumptions and beliefs and emotions and key information that we need in the organization. Okay, how do we get that out of the story? And so I have a series of processes as well for helping people have those conversations, those meaning-making conversations.
So, have you used some of the processes that you've gotten from your interviews? Tell us what's worked.
Yes. Well, of course, there's plenty of my own processes that I've used over the years, and then processes that I've learned from people like you and others in the story space. And yeah, I actually have had an opportunity to experiment with some of those. So for the meaning making, there's a really rich process that was originally developed by Dave Snowden and Cynthia Kurtz at IBM. Uh-huh. If you're familiar with Dave Snowden and the Kinefin framework.
Right. For other people, it's based on complexity theory, right?
He has an entire construct around chaos and complexity, and he connects it to knowledge management and organizations, which is where a lot of the interesting story work is happening right now. It's in knowledge management.
Yeah.
They developed a process that I've experimented with as well, in which you bring groups together. This is after you've identified stories and told stories. So let's say we have our collection of 20 stories now, 30 stories that we've all told together. How do we start pulling the meaning out of that? And there's a process in which you put people into small groups and start capturing answers to the question, what is this story about? Mm-hmm. And so participants capture their answers on sticky notes, one answer per sticky note. You know, I think this is a story about culture change, or I think this is a story about how fearful we are in our department. You know, whatever it is, it's perceptions and beliefs and interpretations. Put all those up on a wall, do some affinity grouping around it, and we're going to start seeing some themes come out now from multiple stories, not just a single story. So now we're seeing collective mental models and assumptions and beliefs and interpretations that the entire group holds that were contained in these stories. And now we're starting to see them grouped up on the wall, and we're starting to see some categories and some themes around that.
Right.
Then there are additional steps that you can do where you name the groups and say, okay, here's an entire theme around our belief in our brand, for example. Let's say that's something that kept coming up. Okay, well, brand is obviously something that's on everybody's minds around here. And you can do another round of analysis. You know, it's kind of like having a solution that a chemist boils down the solution so that all the extra stuff evaporates and you're left with, would that be the solute? I'm not a chemist.
We'll call it that. Yeah, absolutely.
It's the solute that's left. And so it's a process where the group just keeps boiling down the meaning through multiple iterations of drawing the meaning out. And it's a fascinating process that I just recently tried with a new client, and it was a really rich experience.
I'm curious because does that note, is it coded with the original story? Because for me, when you talk about boiling it down, and you take a story about a woman who started buying flowers for the office every week, and somebody takes that story and boils it down to be culture change. For me, we've lost the variability nature and the paradox nature of story, so that when we have, ultimately, we've got this category that says culture change on the wall, we're at the same place we were when somebody came in and said, you know, we need to change our culture. Now how do we do it? And I would be gathering stories about how to do it. So you'll have to explain to me, you know, kind of tell me where I'm wrong.
Okay. Well, the process goes deeper than what I've quickly shared with you. First of all, no, we don't lose the story.
Oh, okay.
Now, what we do is during the conversation, temporarily step away from the story.
Okay.
Because now we're talking about shared mental models.
Right.
And it's deeper this time, because it's not somebody who's come in and said, we need to talk about culture change.
Right.
It's everybody in this room has some beliefs around culture, and we just demonstrated them.
Right.
And now we're talking about something that we've all revealed because it came from all of us.
Okay.
So there's that. Now, what about the story? There's a couple things you can do in this process. One is simply have the conversation around the mental models, which is rich. We still have the stories because we've captured them earlier, and there's any number of ways of capturing stories, whether it's, you know, put them in a story bank, database, video, maybe they're in a written form.
I got a question before we go on, because the way I do it, and the way I've seen you do it, is to have a whole bunch of people in a room and give them some skills of storytelling and then have them come up with stories. And so those stories are now shared within the small group. Are you saying that these stories, should that be the process, get videotaped or written?
Okay, so we've been describing the meaning-making piece of
right.
it. So let's back up then and
right.
talk about story mining and story capture, which are different processes. And you're right, those presumably would come first.
Because I can't understand this other piece unless I understand what form you have these stories in.
It can be any form. There's lots of forms. It can be in a story bank, stories that have already been captured. It can be in a shared social construct where we've been in groups of three and
uh-huh.
we've taken turns telling stories to
uh-huh.
each other. Perhaps we've captured them in written form. Perhaps we've taken another step where we've actually begun processing them and tagging them. You know, this is a story about brand. This is a story about change
okay.
management.
Okay.
So that they become searchable in the database.
Okay. Okay.
So
when we go to meaning making, at least in Snowden's case, he's got something like a database to work with. So that when you kind of mine down and get the collective themes, that then all of the stories stay attached.
Yes.
Okay.
So whether it's a database or something more crude and analog, like just a bunch of stories that we've written down on paper.
Right.
But this process does assume that we have some bank of stories that we've told to one another
okay.
and heard
okay.
from each
okay.
other.
Okay, that's what I didn't understand. Okay,
yeah.
All right.
And the other thing we can do is, you know, in the process, everybody pulls out their iPhone and takes a picture of the wall.
Yeah.
Karen Dietz, if you know her.
Uh-huh, we've talked to her already.
Oh, wonderful. She has a process called a story depth chart, where she'll capture the stories in a spreadsheet. And now we can go back and take all these different ideas and mental models and themes and in the spreadsheet start connecting them to different stories. So now we've got all the stories, and along with each story we have archetypes, mental models, key ideas connected with them, and now we can sort that spreadsheet so we can say, what are all the stories that had something important to say about culture and identity, for example. So you can codify that and then make it searchable and accessible.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Wow. So, and a regular person listening, you know, could do that as long as they can figure out how to do a spreadsheet, right?
The idea of this book of tools that I'm putting together is to simplify it enough so that leaders and team leaders who are not facilitators
right.
can start to do some of this work.
Right.
And I think they can.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So when these stories have been codified and we have the themes, then we bring strategy in?
Potentially. Yes. That has not been a part of my work. At least I have not made the connection with my clients. Let me back up and say that differently. When I've done this work, strategy has already been established, so there's something that we're trying to accomplish.
Okay.
So, for example, when I did this process, it was around the topic of institutional memory.
Uh-huh.
There's an organization that has done several years of some really good work, and they've stopped and said, wait a minute, we have not captured this.
Wow.
And
it took them a while to figure that one out.
It took 4 years to figure it out. Some companies, it takes 50 years, I guess, to
yeah.
figure it out, right? So, you know, good for them for figuring it out after 4 years. And they're recognizing that story is the way to capture wisdom and knowledge. You know, you can capture processes. You can capture data, but learning and wisdom and data they recognize require something deeper. So in this case, there is a strategic imperative that has already been defined that's driving the story initiative, and that is to capture the learning and wisdom of the organization over the past 4 years and make it available, especially as they onboard lots and lots of new employees, make it available and accessible to many, many people who will be coming into the organization. So it's couched in strategy. It doesn't deliver a strategy. The strategy came first.
Right. Oh, goodness. I'm going to date myself. But in 1994, 95, I was working in organizational leadership, and my mentor, Jim Farr, had an incredible process for a self-awareness workshop that was delivered in highly variable ways depending on the individual delivering it. And we would tell stories as a part of this delivery. Now, our clients included a whole lot of banks, and knowledge management was just becoming popular. And so I was put into an office with this IT guy, because I'm the one that was always following Jim Farr around, my mentor, and documenting everything he did, because the guy was so brilliant, he didn't even know what he did, you know? And so I was constantly documenting what he did. And so they had me share an office with Martin Messick, one of my best friends forever, who was an anthropologist. He happened to speak fluent Japanese. He was just a total Renaissance man at the time. And our job was to capture the knowledge. You know, knowledge management was just becoming the big deal. And yet, when we got the stories, the translation of the stories into writing, people just aren't good writers. And the stories lost so much when we translated them into writing. Is there anything new that I should know about how that is better now?
Did you transcribe recordings of spoken stories into writing, or did you ask them to write their stories?
We transcribe spoken stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we asked them to write the stories, for one thing, we never got them. You know, people just didn't do it.
Right. I've encountered that too.
Right.
So the question is, what do we do with stories that we have transcribed into a written form?
I mean, how do you create that database? Because the personal story, one of the speakers at the storytelling conference, I can't remember his name, he's wonderful, maybe Bill Harley, I don't know, says that oral storytelling, and it's oral storytelling, is a story told in a particular place, at a particular time, to a particular person. And so stories are embodied, if you will. And I'm trying to figure out how these disembodied stories keep the paradox and the variability of real life.
I haven't fully solved this. First of all, there's the problem that when you transcribe something that somebody said, it's a mess.
It's a mess.
You know, if you transcribed, you know, what I said in this interview, I wouldn't want to read it.
Right.
You know, we can listen to it, but reading it, you know, it's all stutters and pauses, and it doesn't work.
Oh, yeah. My boss, that's where we started, is transcribing him. And it was like, oh, my God, this guy is an idiot. He's not wise, because he was all over the place.
So there's that piece. And then the next piece is, it's exactly what you said about context. And with story, the context, the specific time, the specific place, and the specific audience, I think is so sensitive that you lose that. And so far, and not everyone's going to like me for this, but, you know, there's a lot of interest right now in story databases.
Uh-huh.
There's also a lot of people who are frustrated with those because you know, when I capture my story about something I've done in a leadership context and I put it in a leadership database and I say, this is a story about team building. And somebody says, I need team building stories. And they type in team building and here's the story David wrote. And they read that and go, oh, that's interesting, but that's not at all what I'm dealing with. And stories are so contextual that I could look up. And I've experienced this before. You know, when running a training program, I thought, okay, I need a great story about mental models. And I look up 50 of them and I say, no, none of those are what I'm talking about. And then there's one that might be close and I have to adapt it. And it's because context is so sensitive and so nuanced that I think it's difficult to simply take a story out of context and put it in a database and then pull it up later and say, wow, I can really learn from this story. And I don't know how to crack that challenge yet.
Okay. I was hoping you had learned something that we couldn't figure out. Because we've...
A lot of people are struggling with that. I don't know if there's a good solution to that yet.
Well, we finally decided that the evolution of wisdom is very context-driven. Not only context-driven, but also we need context when we're looking. So the human sharing, I know that in knowledge management, have you heard about the coffee table design? Coffee cafe or something like that?
Conversation cafe.
Yeah, conversation cafe.
Yes.
Have you done that?
Many times.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good construct. And what it does is illustrates exactly what you and I are saying right now, which is that the knowledge and the wisdom transfer happens in the soup of human experience. And
I guess we should describe what we're talking about when we say... So basically, we have people that are in some way... directed to sit at small tables with others and discuss particular issues, and then everybody rotates and they go to different tables. Is that it?
That's close. So I've done this in, you know, banquet halls with 300 participants, so
right.
It's very scalable. So yes, there's a topic of conversation. It's set up as small tables, so you know you have to get real close, and you know it feels intimate. Often people will put, you know, the table is paper and there's markers so you can write on the tables. When you rotate and it's randomized, so you end up sitting down with a new group of people, a key thing is one person remains at the table. And so that person represents the memory of what just happened at that table. So now two or three new people come, let's say I'm the guy who stays, three people come and sit down at the table with me. And I can say, yeah, we just had a really interesting conversation about why mergers and acquisitions always fail. And maybe we'll riff. I'm making stuff up.
No. But I mean, when I wrote the book Territorial Games, that was I did a lot of work in M&A.
Good. Maybe you can tell me why they fail. But, you know, I represent the memory. And so now there's like this seed of meaning that has been left at the table. And maybe more meaning will be built around that. Or, you know, consistent with emergent processes, maybe something else will happen. And so now we have a room full of these conversations with meaning just bubbling up at different tables. And because you have people who represent the meaning who are capturing a piece of meaning from the conversations, you start getting this collective emergence where themes start happening and coming together kind of organically in the room. It's really a fascinating process.
I think it's totally fascinating. And again, I come up with my issue about, you know, then because that experience for me is a mind meld. It's like the Vulcan mind meld, if you remember the original Star Trek. We're about 300 people, and all of a sudden, where 300 people came in with different stories, then like the five blind men with the elephant, each having a different piece, all of a sudden 300 different blind men now see the whole elephant all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that as having a dramatic effect on organizational behavior for the next, you know, 5 years. And I have not satisfied myself that the database capturing really enhances that behavior change any more than the personal experiences.
And I'm not satisfied about that either.
Okay.
And so when I work with a group, invariably, they are fixated on the capture and archive.
I know.
Everybody wants that. And so it's an important nut to crack, so I'm not going to dismiss it. But part of the conversation I do have is, yes, let's work on this, let's talk about this, but recognize that if we did not capture it and we merely had the conversations together in a room and then went out to the lobby and started talking amongst ourselves,
right,
a great deal has happened.
Right.
And that is not, if you never captured it, you've still accomplished a great deal.
Yeah, I almost, you know, you can tell where I come from. I think that the capturing is kind of a distraction. And it implies that, you know, there's not more to do in a way. But you think the people think they have something done when it actually isn't done, you know, when they feel like they've captured the stories. Because here's what happened with, you know, at Far Associates is that, you know, we captured all this stuff and then nobody found it usable. Ultimately, you know, Martin and I did the best we could. And this is a small organization. You know, this wasn't big, but the staff meetings where the stories are shared that really made the difference for us. And of course, you're talking about these large groups.
And yet, you know, I still have a vivid memory of a trip to Washington, D.C., where my wife and I and our kids went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which is a massively, astonishingly impactful experience. And at the end of that exhibit is a theater just on the side. You know, don't even have a back wall. You can just go in and sit on benches. And it's the Steven Spielberg initiative where he is capturing the stories from surviving Holocaust people. And, you know, as time goes on, there's fewer and fewer of those people.
That's right.
They're very old and they're dying. And Steven Spielberg has an initiative where he says, I have to capture these stories. And so running nonstop is a film with surviving with Holocaust survivors telling stories.
Wow, what an incredible experience.
And we were just enwrapped by this experience. And, you know, people will sit there for 2 hours watching these stories, and I still remember some of the stories I heard.
You'll never forget them.
Never forget them. So here's a case where the stories were captured.
Right.
By non-professional storytellers.
Well, tell me about the non-professional storytellers. Is it just people, their family members had them sit down and tell the story?
It was the actual survivor. So it's elderly people looking directly into Steven Spielberg's camera.
Okay, so it was a film crew that went out.
It's a film crew, yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, they're talking, they're looking at you, the audience.
Right.
And they're telling their stories. So, yeah, not professional, but credible, because it's their stories.
No, see, this, you know, this is where I become a pill again. Because if you're Spielberg, you can get that kind of performance out of somebody. I mean, I work with some videographers myself. And if you take your iPhone out there to get some stories, have you done that? Have you done that where you take your iPhone and you ask people to just tell stories?
Or with an iPad, yes.
Right, okay. My experience has been that it's not the Spielberg, you know, sort of quality. As a matter of fact, that there's a lot of editing that goes into the stories that I gather. And then in order to make them in a window of like 2 or 3 minutes, because people have only so long to watch these stories. My experience is that I have to do a lot of editing. And I'm guessing that Spielberg had the money to pay the editors and that sort of stuff. There's no way that I want to imply that that wasn't an awesome experience and that
right.
I don't wish that people would do that. It's just that okay, I'm not Spielberg. What is it that we're going to be able to do?
So you capture the stories. Now we have a massive amount of raw data.
Right.
And I am convinced that part of this process is having an intermediary, a curator,
right.
someone like Annette Simmons or a Steven Spielberg, who comes in and makes decisions about the content. So now we're going through another filter of human interpretation, which is not a bad thing.
No.
Now, the data propeller heads will say that is a bad thing. I'm saying no, we're all constantly sending the stories through our filters of interpretation.
And you're adding art back into the process.
In Spielberg's case, he's adding art and beauty to it. In our case, yeah, maybe we'll add some...
Art and beauty is meaning. I mean, that's when you turn something into art, you're just taking something that is not saying what it has to express, and you're transforming it into pure meaning. For me, I mean, that's what art is. Art is meaning making. artist taking the trash by the side of the road and reconstructing it so that somebody looks at it and they get, you know, some sort of emotion or reaction. And so for me, art is inherent in the process. And so when you're adding this person, you're adding an artist.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Because, you know, everything is objective and subjective in my model. And so you've got the objective stuff, but the subjective stuff, if you're not going to lose it, what you're telling me is that's a great way to not lose it or to make sure it continues to live. So what do you have this person do?
This intermediary?
Uh-huh.
This is another case where the conversation is evolving quickly, because today a lot of people are talking about curation. I mean, that's the other buzzword right now. And so there seems to be this rapidly growing and accepted idea that there is somebody that you bring in as kind of a chief meaning maker.
Right.
You know,
Like an anthropologist. Ethnographer, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, I'm going to make decisions about all the stories, and some of them I'm going to cut off the beginning, or some of them I'm going to cut off the end, and some of them I'm going to put in front of you, and others I'm going to keep back here because I don't think they're as vital. And so I'm going to take all this stuff and I'm going to shape it into something that I think says something about who we are as an organization. And that's yeah. In Hollywood, that's the director. In organizations, that's either the organizational storyteller or the curator,
right.
The identity curator.
Yeah, and that I would think that person needs to be something of an artist.
Yeah.
That's cool. That is really cool.
Mm-hmm. But the database that's just raw, unfiltered, unedited stories is, I think, of limited utility.
Yeah. Well, tell me what you're excited about right now.
I'm working on a project that's a lot of fun. I don't know if this is off topic or not.
Okay.
Did I tell you earlier about I told you about the stuff with the U.S. Olympic Committee, right?
Well, these people don't know, so you have to tell them.
Okay. This is more story work. So since a lot of my work is learning and learning design, I'm partnering with the Conference Board out of New York City. And we have a series of immersive leadership experiences that are all story based. So one of them is the Apollo leadership experience. So we will bring an executive team to Johnson Space Center in Houston, sit with astronauts and rocket scientists and have conversations about innovation.
Yeah.
All through the stories that they tell. And so my job as the facilitator or the meaning maker is to help connect those stories to, okay, well, in your organization, you're not a science-based rocket organization. You're an insurance company. What does this have to do with you? Let's translate these messages to an insurance company.
The analogies.
It's an analogy.
And
sometimes you tell a story that's far removed from our reality. And those tend to be more aspirational because now we can see things that we couldn't see when we were just talking about our reality.
Yeah.
So the new program is that I can now talk about publicly because now we are now officially marketing it. It's for real. Is the Team USA Leadership Experience, and this is at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, and so we bring executive teams out to meet with athletes and sports psychologists and sports scientists and organizational leaders and talk about how do you create performance in an organization. It's the most fun thing I've ever worked on.
Oh, my gosh.
So cool.
Oh, my gosh. I want to go. I want to attend
so
it.
Cool.
Yeah. So tell people how much this costs and how they can find it.
It's kind of a lot of money. But
okay.
Go to the conference board. .org, and there's a tab on their menu that's the immersive leadership experiences. You'll see it.
Okay.
And there's several others. There's the Gettysburg leadership experience and the Normandy leadership experience and so on.
So when y'all sell these, you're basically selling it to a whole organizational team. So they come as an intact team.
Right.
And how much time do they spend there?
Two and a half days.
Two and a half days.
So awesome. we wine them and dine them,
yeah.
And spend 2 days either walking the battlefields of Gettysburg or sitting in mission control at NASA or playing Paralympic sitting volleyball at the Olympic Training Center, and then telling stories.
Wow, that's wonderful. And then those stories are allowed to do just their natural thing. They're not really captured, you know, in any sort of, you know, I have it in my hand way. They're shared, and that experience does its thing, right?
Exactly right. I'm not interested in codifying the stories that come out of that.
Right.
It's the experience.
So, storytelling, we talked a little bit in the beginning about what we may have lost in using this umbrella term. I think one of the things is that whole codifying effort. I think one of those things, for me, personally, obviously, it's probably just something I don't want to do, you know.
Right.
I like the art part, you know, that's my thing. And getting people inspired to tell their stories in very, very personal ways. Brown's work on vulnerability, I think, has really influenced my work, because sharing these stories does require some, you have to either reveal your deepest passions or you have to reveal your fears if you're going to be telling a story that is truly meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, is about what is most important, what is most precious. And I think that whatever's most precious, that's the very definition of our passions and our fears.
I'm interested in that vulnerability piece as well. And, you know, I often challenge my groups to tell stories of a failure.
Right.
I think you call it the time I blew it story.
Right. Right.
In Simmons, the Simmons terminology. And you've probably discovered this. Those are harder stories. It's an organizational culture issue. Some organizations are very good about that.
Right.
In some organizations, I say, now let's tell a story about a time that you blew it. And it's like somebody farted in the room.
Right.
I mean, people just freeze. It's like, I can't believe you just said that, you know?
Are you kidding?
Yeah,
well,
it fails. No one will do it.
I worked at one of those really, really big consulting firms where it's up or out, you mm-hmm. know? And their culture just did not incorporate the idea of an I blew it story until the CEO got up and told an I blew it story. And it changed everything. It was awesome. It was a great, great experience. It really was.
One of my favorite examples of I blew it stories is I did some work last year with Engineers Without Borders. It's
uh-huh.
a group in Canada. It's an amazing group. But they have a website called admittingfailure.com.
Wow.
From Engineers Without Borders. And it's failure stories where they challenge the members of the organization not just to tell these stories, but to post them publicly on the website. So it's complete vulnerability and transparency. And they say it is key to how they have created a culture of learning in their organization is by announcing these stories to the world. Let us tell you all the things we've done wrong. Go check it out. It's really
beautiful. I will. I wish we could do something like that in healthcare. One of the stumbling blocks in patient safety and quality, et cetera, has been that, of course, in healthcare, you never admit anything you did wrong because you're going to get sued.
Right, right.
And as we try to adapt the safety designs from the safest organizations in the world, which is airlines, the FAA has these incredible procedures that safeguard and reduce safety to the point where it's safer, you know, to get on an airplane than it is to go to the hospital. A lot safer, actually. But they depend on managing errors, not identifying them and squashing them, but understanding that errors happen. And so in that environment, then you can manage them and dramatically reduce them. But if you don't tell these, you know, failure stories, and in healthcare it's just dangerous to tell them still, then we can't use those FAA designs.
Yeah, healthcare has a problem with this. If they tell the stories, they're in trouble. if they don't tell the stories, they're in trouble. You know, it's I don't know the solution for that.
Yeah, well, that's more. I like the psychology part. That's I love that part. And
right.
And the, you know, most of the work I do when I'm working with an organization is reducing defenses before I get these stories out there. I spend a whole lot of time doing that before I go to the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
This has been terrific. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you, Annette.
Thank you. Now, you can find David Hutchins at davidhutchins.com, right?
You have to spell it correctly. It's with an E-N-S, not an I-N-S.
That's right. I've done that. DavidHutchins.com. That was David Hutchins. And you've been listening to the Story Factor podcast. I'd love to continue our conversation. You can tweet me on Twitter at thestoryfactor.com or email me, Annette@AnnetteSimmons.com. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about the show. You can even record a message on the Story Factor podcast feedback line at 318-479-1077. I'm Annette Simmons, and I hope you'll come back to join us next time on the Story Factor Podcast.